Welcome to Marilyn Lightstone Reads The Secret Garden, Frances Hodgson Burnett's heartwarming story of young orphan Mary Lennox that celebrates the power of nature, friendship, and the human spirit. This is the latest title in our podcast series, Marilyn Lightstone Reads. If this is your first time with us, you can find all the other novels plus new episodes at classicalfm.ca or through your favorite podcast app. Now, let's turn to Marilyn as she reads The Secret Garden.
Chapter 6.
There was someone crying. There was.
The next day, the rain poured down in torrents again, and when Mary looked out of her window, the moor was almost hidden by gray mist and cloud. There could be no going out today.
"What do you do in your cottage when it rains like this?"
she asked Martha.
"Try to keep from under each other's feet, mostly,"
Martha answered.
"Eh, there does seem a lot of us then. Mother's a good-tempered woman, but she gets fair moithered. The biggest ones goes out in the cowshed and plays there. Dickon, he doesn't mind the wet. He goes out just the same as if the sun was shining. He says he sees things on rainy days as doesn't show when it's fair weather. He once found a little fox cub half drowned in its hole, and he brought it home in the bosom of his shirt to keep it warm. Its mother had been killed nearby, and the hole was swum out, and the rest of the litter was dead. He's got it at home now. He found a half-drowned young crow another time, and he brought it home, too, and tamed it. It's named Soot because it's so black, and it hops and flies about with him everywhere."
The time had come when Mary had forgotten to resent Martha's familiar talk. She had even begun to find it interesting, and to be sorry when she stopped or went away. The story she had been told by her ayah when she lived in India had been quite unlike those Martha had to tell about the moorland cottage, which held 14 people who lived in 4 little rooms and never had quite enough to eat. The children seemed to tumble about and amuse themselves like a litter of rough, good-natured collie puppies. Mary was most attracted by the mother and Dickon. When Martha told stories of what Mother said or did, they always sounded comfortable.
"If I had a raven or a fox cub, I could play with it," said Mary, "but I have nothing."
Martha looked perplexed.
"Can thou knit?" she asked.
"No,"
answered Mary. "Can thou sew?"
"No."
"Can thou read?"
"Yes."
"Then why doesn't thou read something or learn a bit of spelling? Thou's old enough to be learning thy book a good bit now."
"I haven't any books," said Mary. "Those I had were left in India."
"Oh, that's a pity," said Martha. "If Mrs. Medlock had let thee go into the library, there's thousands of books there."
Mary did not ask where the library was, because she was suddenly inspired by a new idea. She made up her mind to go and find it herself. She was not troubled about Mrs. Medlock. Mrs. Medlock seemed always to be in her comfortable housekeeper's sitting room downstairs. In this queer place, one scarcely ever saw anyone at all. In fact, there was no one to see but the servants, and when their master was away, they lived a luxurious life below stairs, where there was a huge kitchen hung about with shining brass and pewter, and a large servants' hall where there were 4 or 5 abundant meals eaten every day, and where a great deal of lively romping about went on when Mrs. Medlock was out of the way. Mary's meals were served regularly, and Martha waited on her, but no one troubled themselves about her in the least. Mrs. Medlock came and looked at her every day or two, but no one inquired what she did or told her what to do. She supposed that perhaps this was the English way of treating children. In India, she had always been attended by her ayah, who had followed her about and waited on her hand and foot. She had often been tired of her company. Now she was followed by nobody, and was learning to dress herself, because Martha looked as though she thought she was silly and stupid when she wanted to have things handed to her and put on.
"Hasn't thou got good sense?"
she said once, when Mary had stood waiting for her to put on her gloves for her.
"Our Susan Ann is twice as sharp as thee, and she's only 4 year old. Sometimes thou looks there soft in the head."
Mary had worn her contrary scowl for an hour after that, but it made her think several entirely new things. She stood at the window for about 10 minutes this morning after Martha had swept up the hearth for the last time and gone downstairs. She was thinking over the new idea which had come to her when she heard of the library. She did not care very much about the library itself, because she had read very few books, but to hear of it brought back to her mind the 100 rooms with closed doors. She wondered if they were all really locked, and what she would find if she could get into any of them. Were there 100, really? Why shouldn't she go and see how many doors she could count? It would be something to do on this morning when she could not go out. She had never been taught to ask permission to do things, and she knew nothing at all about authority, so she would not have thought it necessary to ask Mrs. Medlock if she might walk about the house, even if she had seen her. She opened the door of the room and went into the corridor, and then she began her wanderings. It was a long corridor, and it branched into other corridors, and it led her up short flights of steps which mounted to others again. There were doors and doors, and there were pictures on the walls. Sometimes they were pictures of dark, curious landscapes, but oftenest they were portraits of men and women in queer, grand costumes made of satin and velvet. She found herself in one long gallery whose walls were covered with these portraits. She had never thought there could be so many in any house. She walked slowly down this place and stared at the faces, which also seemed to stare at her. She felt as if they were wondering what a little girl from India was doing in their house. Some were pictures of children, little girls in thick satin frocks which reached to their feet and stood out about them, and boys with puffed sleeves and lace collars and long hair, or with big ruffs around their necks. She always stopped to look at the children and wonder what their names were and where they had gone and why they wore such odd clothes. There was a stiff, plain little girl, rather like herself. She wore a green brocade dress and held a green parrot on her finger. Her eyes had a sharp, curious look. "Where do you live now?" said Mary aloud to her. "I wish you were here." Surely no other little girl ever spent such a queer morning. It seemed as if there was no one in all the huge rambling house but her own small self, wandering about upstairs and down, through narrow passages and wide ones, where it seemed to her that no one but herself had ever walked. Since so many rooms had been built, people must have lived in them, but it all seemed so empty that she could not quite believe it true. It was not until she climbed to the second floor that she thought of turning the handle of a door. All the doors were shut, as Mrs. Medlock had said they were, but at last she put her hand on the handle of one of them and turned it. She was almost frightened for a moment when she felt that it turned without difficulty, and that when she pushed open the door itself, it slowly and heavily opened. It was a massive door, and opened into a big bedroom. There were embroidered hangings on the wall, and inlaid furniture such as she had seen in India stood about the room. A broad window with leaded panes looked out upon the moor, and over the mantel was another portrait of the stiff, plain little girl who seemed to stare at her more curiously than ever. "Perhaps she slept here once," said Mary. "She stares at me so that she makes me feel queer." After that, she opened more doors, and more. She saw so many rooms that she became quite tired, and began to think that there must be 100, though she had not counted them. In all of them, there were old pictures or old tapestries with strange scenes worked on them. There were curious pieces of furniture and curious ornaments in nearly all of them. In one room, which looked like a lady's sitting room, the hangings were all embroidered velvet, and in a cabinet were about 100 little elephants made of ivory. They were of different sizes, and some had their mahouts or palanquins on their backs. Some were much bigger than the others, and some were so tiny that they seemed only babies. Mary had seen carved ivory in India, and she knew all about elephants. She opened the door of the cabinet and stood on a footstool and played with these for quite a long time. When she got tired, she set the elephants in order and shut the door of the cabinet. In all her wanderings through the long corridors and the empty rooms, she had seen nothing alive. But in this room, she saw something. Just after she had closed the cabinet door, she heard a tiny rustling sound. It made her jump and look around at the sofa by the fireplace, from which it seemed to come. In the corner of the sofa, there was a cushion, and in the velvet which covered it, there was a hole, and out of the hole peeped a tiny head with a pair of frightened eyes in it. Mary crept softly across the room to look. The bright eyes belonged to a little gray mouse, and the mouse had eaten a hole into the cushion and made a comfortable nest there. Six baby mice were cuddled up asleep near her. If there was no one else alive in the 100 rooms, there were 7 mice who did not look lonely at all. "If they wouldn't be so frightened, I would take them back with me," said Mary. She had wandered about long enough to feel too tired to wander any farther, and she turned back. 2 or 3 times she lost her way by turning down the wrong corridor and was obliged to ramble up and down until she found the right one. But at last she reached her own floor again, though she was some distance from her own room and did not know exactly where she was. "I believe I have taken a wrong turning again," she said, standing still at what seemed the end of a short passage with tapestry on the wall. "I don't know which way to go. How still everything is." It was while she was standing here, and just after she had said this, that the stillness was broken by a sound. It was another cry, but not quite like the one she had heard last night. It was only a short one, a fretful, childish whine muffled by passing through walls. "It's nearer than it was," said Mary, her heart beating rather faster. "And it is crying." She put her hand accidentally upon the tapestry near her and then sprang back, feeling quite startled. The tapestry was the covering of a door which fell open and showed her that there was another part of the corridor behind it, and Mrs. Medlock was coming up it with her bunch of keys in her hand and a very cross look on her face. "What are you doing here?" she said, and she took Mary by the arm and pulled her away. "What did I tell you?"
"I turned round the wrong corner," explained Mary. "I didn't know which way to go, and I heard someone crying."
She quite hated Mrs. Medlock at the moment, but she hated her more the next.
"You didn't hear anything of the sort," said the housekeeper. "You come along back to your own nursery, or I'll box your ears."
And she took her by the arm and half pushed, half pulled her up one passage and down another until she pushed her in at the door of her own room.
"Now, you stay here where you're told to stay, or you'll find yourself locked up. The master had better get you a governess, same as he said he would. You're one that needs someone to look sharp after you. I've got enough to do."
She went out of the room and slammed the door after her, and Mary went and sat on the hearthrug, pale with rage. She did not cry, but ground her teeth.
"There was someone crying. There was, she said to herself.
She had heard it twice now, and sometime she would find out. She had found out a great deal this morning. She felt as if she had been on a long journey, and at any rate she had had something to amuse her all the time, and she had played with the ivory elephants, and had seen the grey mouse and its babies in their nest in the velvet cushion. Chapter 7. The Key to the Garden. 2 days after this, when Mary opened her eyes, she sat upright in bed immediately and called to Martha,
"Look at the moor! Look at the moor!"
The rainstorm had ended, and the grey mist and clouds had been swept away in the night by the wind. The wind itself had ceased, and a brilliant, deep blue sky arched high over the moorland. Never, never had Mary dreamed of a sky so blue. In India, skies were hot and blazing. This was of a deep, cool blue, which almost seemed to sparkle like the waters of some lovely, bottomless lake. And here and there, high, high in the arched blueness, floated small clouds of snow-white fleece. The far-reaching world of the moor itself looked softly blue instead of gloomy purple-black, or awful, dreary gray.
"Aye," said Martha,
with a cheerful grin. "The storm's over for a bit. It does like this at this time of the year. It goes off in a night like it was pretending it had never been here and never meant to come again. That's because the springtime's on its way. It's a long way off yet, but it's coming." "I thought perhaps it always rained or looked dark in England," Mary said. "Oh, no," said Martha, sitting up on her heels among her black lead brushes. "No to the sort."
"What does that mean?" asked Mary seriously. In India, the people spoke different dialects, which only a few people understood, so she was not surprised when Martha used words she did not know. Martha laughed as she had done the first morning.
"There now," she said. "I've talked broad Yorkshire again, like Mrs. Medlock said I mustn't. Now to the sort means nothing of the sort. Slowly and carefully. But it takes so long to say it. Yorkshire's the sunniest place on earth when it is sunny. I told thee that I'd like the moor after a bit. Just you wait till you see the golden-coloured gorse blossoms and the blossoms of the broom and the heather flowering and all the purple bells and hundreds of butterflies fluttering and bees humming and skylarks soaring up and singing. You'll want to get out on it at sunrise and live out on it all day like Dickens does."
"Could I ever get there?" asked Mary wistfully, looking through her window at the far-off blue. It was so new and big and wonderful and such a heavenly colour.
"I don't know," answered Martha. "Tha's never used thy legs since tha was born, it seems to me. Tha couldn't walk 5 miles, 5 miles to our cottage." "I should like to see your cottage."
Martha stared at her a moment curiously before she took up her polishing brush and began to rub the grate again. She was thinking that the small, plain face did not look quite as sour at this moment as it had done the first morning she saw it. It looked just a trifle like little Susan Ann's when she wanted something very much.
"I'll ask my mother about it. She's one of them that nearly always sees a way to do things. It's my day out today and I'm going home, eh? I am glad. Mrs. Medlock thinks a lot of mother. Perhaps she could talk to her." "I like your mother," said Mary.
"I should think thou did,"
agreed Martha, polishing away.
"I've never seen her," said Mary.
"No, thou hasn't," replied Martha.
She sat up on her heels again and rubbed the end of her nose with the back of her hand, as if puzzled for a moment, but she ended quite positively.
"Well, she's that sensible and hard-working and good-natured and clean that no one could help liking her, whether they'd seen her or not. When I'm going home to her on my day out, I just jump for joy when I'm crossing the moor."
"I like Dickon," added Mary, "and I've never seen him."
"Well," said Martha stoutly, "I've told thee that the very birds likes him, and the rabbits and wild sheep and ponies and the foxes themselves.
I wonder," staring at her reflectively, "what Dickon would think of thee."
"He wouldn't like me," said Mary in her stiff, cold little way. "No one does."
"Mary," Martha looked reflective again.
"How dost thou like thyself?"
she inquired, really quite as if she were curious to know. Mary hesitated a moment and thought it over.
"Not at all, really," she answered. "But I never thought of that before. Mother said that to me once," she said. "She was at her washtub and I was in a bad temper and talking ill of folk, and she turns round on me and says, 'Thou young vixen, thou! There thou stand saying thou doesn't like this one and thou doesn't like that one. How dost thou like thyself?' It made me laugh, and it brought me to my senses in a minute."
She went away in high spirits as soon as she had given Mary her breakfast. She was going to walk 5 miles across the moor to the cottage, and she was going to help her mother with the washing and do the week's baking and enjoy herself thoroughly. Mary felt lonelier than ever when she knew she was no longer in the house. She went out into the garden as quickly as possible, and the first thing she did was to run round and round the fountain flower garden 10 times. She counted the times carefully, and when she had finished, she felt in better spirits. The sunshine made the whole place look different. The high, deep blue sky arched over Misselthwaite as well as over the moor, and she kept lifting her face and looking up into it, trying to imagine what it would be like to lie down on one of the little snow-white clouds and float about. She went into the first kitchen garden and found Ben Weatherstaff working there with two other gardeners. The change in the weather seemed to have done him good. He spoke to her of his own accord.
"Springtime is coming," he said. "Cannot thou smell it?"
Mary sniffed and thought she could.
"I smell something nice and fresh and damp," she said.
"That's the good, rich earth," he answered, digging away. "It's in a good humour, making ready to grow things. It's glad when planting time comes. It's dull in the winter when it's got nought to do.
In the flower gardens out there, things will be stirring down below in the dark. The sun's warming 'em. You'll see bits of green spikes sticking out of the black earth after a bit."
"What will they be?" asked Mary.
"Crocuses and snowdrops and daffy-down-dillies. Has thou never seen them?"
"No. Everything is hot and wet and green after the rains in India," said Mary. "And I think things grow up in a night."
"Oh, those won't grow up in a night," said Weatherstaff. "Thou'll have to wait for 'em. They'll poke up a bit higher here and push out a spike more there, and uncurl a leaf this day and another that. You watch 'em."
"I'm going to," answered Mary.
Very soon she heard the soft rustling flight of wings again, and she knew at once that the robin had come again. He was very pert and lively, and hopped about so close to her feet, and put his head on one side, and looked at her so slyly that she asked Ben Weatherstaff a question.
"Do you think he remembers me?"
she said.
"Remembers thee?" said Weatherstaff indignantly. "He knows every cabbage stump in the gardens, let alone the people. He's never seen a little wench here before, and he's bent on finding out all about thee. There's no need to try to hide anything from him."
"Are things stirring down below in the dark in that garden where he lives?" Mary inquired.
"What garden?" grunted Weatherstaff, becoming surly again.
"The one where the old rose trees are."
She could not help asking, because she wanted so much to know.
"Are all the flowers dead? Or do some of them come again in the summer? Or are there ever any roses?"
"Ask him," said Ben Weatherstaff, hunching his shoulders towards the robin. "He's the only one as knows. No one else has seen inside it for 10 year.
10 years was a long time, Mary thought. She had been born 10 years ago. She walked away, slowly, thinking. She had begun to like the garden just as she had begun to like the robin and Dickon and Martha's mother. She was beginning to like Martha, too. That seemed a good many people to like when you were not used to liking. She thought of the robin as one of the people. She went to her walk outside the long, ivy-covered wall over which she could see the treetops, and the second time she walked up and down, the most interesting and exciting thing happened to her, and it was all through Ben Weatherstaff's robin. She heard a chirp and a twitter, and when she looked at the bare flower bed at her left side, there he was hopping about and pretending to peck things out of the earth to persuade her that he had not followed her. But she knew he had followed her, and the surprise so filled her with delight that she almost trembled a little.
"You do remember me. You do. You do. You are prettier than anything else in the world."
She chirped and talked and coaxed, and he hopped and flirted his tail and twittered. It was as if he were talking. His red waistcoat was like satin, and he puffed his tiny breast out and was so fine and so grand and so pretty that it was really as if he were showing her how important and how like a human person a robin could be. Mistress Mary forgot that she had ever been contrary in her life when he allowed her to draw closer and closer to him and bend down and talk and try to make something like robin sounds.
Oh, to think that he should actually let her come as near to him as that!
He knew nothing in the world would make her put out her hand toward him or startle him in the least tiniest way. He knew it because he was a real person, only nicer than any other person in the world. She was so happy that she scarcely dared to breathe. The flower bed was not quite bare. It was bare of flowers because the perennial plants had been cut down for their winter rest, but there were tall shrubs and low ones which grew together at the back of the bed. and as the robin hopped about under them, she saw him hop over a small pile of freshly turned up earth. He stopped on it to look for a worm. The earth had been turned up because a dog had been trying to dig up a mole, and he had scratched quite a deep hole. Mary looked at it, not really knowing why the hole was there. And as she looked, she saw something almost buried in the newly turned soil. It was something like a ring of rusty iron or brass, and when the robin flew up into a tree nearby, she put out her hand and picked the ring up. It was more than a ring, however. It was an old key, which looked as if it had been buried a long time. Mistress Mary stood up and looked at it with an almost frightened face as it hung from her finger.
"Perhaps it has been buried for 10 years," she said. Perhaps it is the key to the garden.
Chapter 8. The Robin Who Showed the Way. She looked at the key quite a long time. She turned it over and over and thought about it. As I have said before, she was not a child who had been trained to ask permission or consult her elders about things. All she thought about the key was that if it was the key to the closed garden, and she could find out where the door was, she could perhaps open it and see what was inside the walls and what had happened to the old rose trees. It was because it had been shut up so long that she wanted to see it. It seemed as if it must be different from other places, and that something strange must have happened to it during 10 years. Besides that, if she liked it, she could go into it every day and shut the door behind her, and she could make up some play of her own and play it quite alone, because nobody would ever know where she was, but would think the door was still locked and the key buried in the earth. That thought pleased her very much. Living as it were all by herself in a house with 100 mysteriously closed rooms, and having nothing whatsoever to do to amuse herself, had set her inactive brain to working, and was actually awakening her imagination. There is no doubt that the fresh, strong, pure air from the moor had a great deal to do with it. Just as it had given her an appetite, and fighting with the wind had stirred her blood, so the same things had stirred her mind. In India, she had always been too hot and languid and weak to care much about anything. But in this place, she was beginning to care and to want to do new things. Already she felt less contrary, though she did not know why. She put the key in her pocket and walked up and down her walk. No one but herself ever seemed to come there, so she could walk quite slowly and look at the wall, or rather, at the ivy growing on it. The ivy was the baffling thing. Howsoever carefully she looked, she could see nothing but thickly growing, glossy, dark green leaves. She was very much disappointed. Something of her contrariness came back to her as she paced the walk and looked over it at the treetops inside. It seemed so silly, she said to herself, to be near it and not to be able to get in. She took the key in her pocket when she went back to the house, and she made up her mind that she would always carry it with her when she went out, so that if ever she should find the hidden door, she would be ready. Mrs. Medlock had allowed Martha to sleep all night at the cottage, but she was back at her work in the morning, with cheeks redder than ever and in the best of spirits. "I got up at 4 o'clock," she said. "Eh, it was pretty on the moor with the birds getting up and the rabbits scampering about in the sun rising. I didn't walk all the way. A man gave me a ride in his cart, and I did enjoy myself." She was full of stories of the delights of her day out. Her mother had been glad to see her, and they had got the baking and washing all out of the way. She had even made each of the children a dough cake with a bit of brown sugar in it. "I had him all piping hot when they came in from playing on the moor, and the cottage all smelt a nice clean hot bacon, and there was a good fire, and they just shouted for joy. Our Dickon, he said our cottage was good enough for a king." In the evening, they had all sat round the fire, and Martha and her mother had sewed patches on torn clothes and mended stockings, and Martha had told them about the little girl who had come from India, who had been waited on all her life until she didn't know how to put on her own stockings.
"Hey, they did like to hear about you," said Martha. "They wanted to know all about India and about the ship you came in. I couldn't tell them enough."
Mary reflected a little.
"I'll tell you a great deal more before your next day out," she said, "so that you will have more to talk about. I dare say they would like to hear about riding on elephants and camels and about the officers going to hunt tigers."
"My word!" cried delighted Martha. "It would set them clean off their heads. Would they really do that, miss?
It would be the same as a wild beast show like we heard they had in York once."
"India's quite different from Yorkshire," Mary said slowly, as she thought the matter over.
"I never thought of that. Did Dickon and your mother like to hear you talk about me?"
"Why, Dickon's eyes nearly started out of his head, they got that round," answered Martha.
"But mother, she was put out about your seeming to be all by yourself like. She said, 'Hasn't Mr. Craven got no governess for her, no nurse?' And I said, 'No, he hasn't. Though Mrs. Medlock says he will when he thinks of it, but she says he mayn't think of it for 2 or 3 years. I don't want a governess,'" said Mary sharply. "But mother says you ought to be learning your book by this time, and you ought to have a woman to look after you. And she says, 'Now, Martha, you just think how you'd feel yourself in a big place like that, wandering about all alone and no mother. You do your best to cheer her up,' she says, and I said I would."
Mary gave her a long, steady look.
"You do cheer me up," she said. "I like to hear you talk."
Presently, Martha went out of the room and came back with something held in her hands under her apron.
"What dost thou think?" she said,
with a cheerful grin.
"I've brought thee a present."
"A present?"
exclaimed Mistress Mary. How could a cottage full of 14 hungry people give anyone a present?
"A man was driving across the moor peddling," Martha explained, "and he stopped his cart at our door. He had pots and pans and odds and ends, but mother had no money to buy anything. Just as he was going away, our Elizabeth Ellen called out, 'Mother, he's got skipping ropes with red and blue handles.' And mother, she calls out quite sudden, 'Here, stop, mister, how much are they?' And he says, 'Tuppence.' And mother, she began fumbling in her pocket, and she says to me, 'Martha, thou'st brought me thy wages like a good lass, and I've got 4 places to put every penny, but I'm just going to take 2 pence out of it to buy that child a skipping rope.' And she bought one, and here it is."
She brought it out from under her apron and exhibited it quite proudly. It was a strong, slender rope with a striped red and blue handle at each end. But Mary Lennox had never seen a skippy rope before. She gazed at it with a mystified expression.
"What is it for?"
she asked curiously.
"For?"
cried out Martha.
"Dost thou mean that they've not got skipping ropes in India, for all they've got elephants and tigers and camels? This is what it's for. Just watch me."
And she ran into the middle of the room, and taking a handle in each hand, began to skip and skip and skip, while Mary turned in her chair to stare at her. And the queer faces in the old portrait seemed to stare at her too, and wonder what on earth this common little cottager had the impudence to be doing under their very noses. But Martha did not even see them. The interest and curiosity in Mistress Mary's face delighted her, and she went on skipping, and she counted as she skipped until she had reached 100.
"I could skip longer than that," she said when she stopped. "I've skipped as much as 500 when I was 12, but I wasn't as fat then as I am now, and I was in practice."
Mary got up from her chair, beginning to feel excited herself.
"It looks nice," she said. "Your mother is a kind woman. Do you think I could ever skip like that?"
"You just try it,"
urged Martha, handing her the skipping rope.
"You can't skip 100 at first, but if you practice, you'll mount up. That's what mother said. She says, nothing will do her more good than skipping rope. It's the sensiblest toy a child can have. Let her play out in the fresh air skipping, and it'll stretch her legs and arms and give her some strength in them."
It was plain that there was not a great deal of strength in Mistress Mary's arms and legs when she first began to skip. She was not very clever at it, but she liked it so much that she did not want to stop.
"Put on that things and run and skip out of doors," said Martha. "Mother said I must tell you to keep out of doors as much as you could, even when it rains a bit, so as thou wrap up warm."
Mary put on her coat and hat and took her skipping rope over her arm. She opened the door to go out, and then suddenly thought of something, and turned back rather slowly.
"Martha," she said, "they were your wages. It was your tuppence, really. Thank you."
She said it stiffly because she was not used to thanking people or noticing that they did things for her.
"Thank you,"
she said, and held out her hand because she did not know what else to do. Martha gave her hand a clumsy little shake, as if she was not accustomed to this sort of thing either. Then she laughed.
"Thou art a queer old womanish thing," she said. "If that had been Elizabeth Ellen, that had given me a kiss."
Mary looked stiffer than ever.
"Do you want me to kiss you?"
Martha laughed again.
"Nay, not me. It's if thou was different, perhaps, thou'd want to thyself. But thou isn't. Run off outside and play with thy rope."
Mistress Mary felt a little awkward as she went out of the room. Yorkshire people seemed strange, and Martha was always rather a puzzle to her. At first she had disliked her very much, but now she did not. The skipping rope was a wonderful thing. She counted and skipped and counted until her cheeks were quite red, and she was more interested than she had ever been since she was born. The sun was shining, and a little wind was blowing. Not a rough wind, but one which came in delightful little gusts and brought a fresh scent of newly turned earth with it. She skipped round the fountain garden, and up one walk and down another. She skipped at last into the kitchen garden and saw Ben Weatherstaff digging and talking to his robin, which was hopping about him. She skipped down the walk toward him, and he lifted his head and looked at her with a curious expression. She had wondered if he would notice her. She wanted him to see her skip.
"Well, well, upon my word, perhaps thou art a young'un after all, and perhaps thou's got child's blood in thy veins instead of sour buttermilk. That skipped red into thy cheeks as sure as my name's Ben Weatherstaff. I wouldn't have believed I could do it."
"I never skipped before," Mary said. "I'm just beginning. I can only go up to 20.
"Thou keep on. Thou shapes well enough at it for a young'un that's lived with heathen. Just see how he's watching thee,"
jerking his head toward the robin.
"He followed after thee yesterday, and he'll be at it again today. He'll be bound to find out what the skipping rope is. He's never seen one. Eh?"
Shaking his head at the bird.
"That curiosity will be the death of thee sometime if thou doesn't look sharp."
Mary skipped round all the gardens and round the orchard, resting every few minutes. At length she went to her own special walk and made up her mind to try if she could skip the whole length of it. It was a good long skip, and she began slowly. But before she had gone halfway down the path, she was so hot and breathless that she was obliged to stop. She did not mind much, because she had already counted up to 30. She stopped with a little laugh of pleasure, and there, lo and behold, was the robin swaying on a long branch of ivy. He had followed her, and he greeted her with a chirp. As Mary had skipped toward him, she felt something heavy in her pocket strike against her at each jump, and when she saw the robin, she laughed again.
"You showed me where the key was yesterday," she said. "You ought to show me the door today. But I don't believe you know."
The robin flew from his swinging spray of ivy onto the top of the wall, and he opened his beak and sang a loud, lovely trill, merely to show off. Nothing in the world is quite as adorably lovely as a robin when he shows off, and they are nearly always doing it. Mary Lennox had heard a great deal about magic in her Ayah stories, and she always said that what happened almost at that moment was magic. One of the nice little gusts of wind rushed down the walk, and it was a stronger one than the rest. It was strong enough to wave the branches of the trees, and it was more than strong enough to sway the trailing sprays of untrimmed ivy hanging from the wall. Mary had stepped close to the robin, and suddenly the gust of wind swung aside some loose ivy trails, and more suddenly still, she jumped toward it and caught it in her hand. This she did because she had seen something under it. A round knob which had been covered by the leaves hanging over it. It was the knob of a door. She put her hands under the leaves and began to pull and push them aside. Thick as the ivy hung, it nearly all was a loose and swinging curtain, though some had crept over wood and iron. Mary's heart began to thump, and her hands to shake a little in her delight and excitement. The robin kept singing and twittering away, and tilting his head on one side as if he were as excited as she was. What was this under her hands, which was square and made of iron, and which her fingers found a hole in? It was the lock of the door which had been closed 10 years, and she put her hand in her pocket, drew out the key, and found it fitted the keyhole. She put the key in and turned it. It took 2 hands to do it, but it did turn. And then she took a long breath and looked behind her up the long walk to see if anyone was coming. No one was coming. No one ever did come, it seemed. And she took another long breath because she could not help it. And she held back the swinging curtain of ivy and pushed back the door, which opened slowly, slowly. Then she slipped through it and shut it behind her and stood with her back against it, looking about her and breathing quite fast with excitement and wonder and delight. She was standing inside the secret garden.
Thanks for listening to Marilyn Lightstone Reads, The Secret Garden. This episode was produced by Duncan Briggs, executive producer Moses Neimer. This is the latest book in our podcast series, Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, Anne of Green Gables, Vanity Fair, and Showboat are just a few of the other novels in the series. You can find them all at classicalfm.ca or wherever you get podcasts. You can also help support this podcast by recommending it to your friends and leaving a 5-star review in your preferred podcast store. And while you're there, look for a variety of other quality podcasts proudly presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network.